Good evening, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you doing?
Hi, Sandy.
It's a pleasure for us to be here, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to see this place. I just had no idea this little garden spot existed up here, and we're taking back some wonderful memories. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 20 years ago, and when I went to my first meeting, I had been sober 6 hours. And I didn't like my first meeting because I saw something, a fatal flaw in Alcoholics Anonymous right during my first meeting. No drinking. And I look back, and I wasn't planning on staying sober and all of that, but I always like to start my talk out by saying, I have not been drunk since that first meeting. And, I didn't mean to applaud. That wasn't the point I was making, but that's all right. I owe it all to not drinking. That's the point I want to make. For the benefit of anybody new, getting drunk is caused by drinking. And that is, that's real bad news and good news. And yet, if just not drinking was the entire program, I know that I probably wouldn't have stuck around that long. What I think Alcoholics Anonymous, and I say this for the benefit of anybody new, what I think the promise here is that we can stay sober and happy at the same time. If sobriety was miserable, I don't know how long I could have lasted, because I can only endure sobriety for just so long, and then something is going to have to give. And early on, I heard something that has stuck with me the years that I've been in, and that is that if you're in AA and you're not happy, you're doing it wrong. And the reason that's such a powerful statement is it puts all the responsibility on my shoulders, where it belongs. It puts it right on the person who has to do the changing, which is me. And while that may be a tough principle to swallow, it is certainly one that, in my judgment, offers a great deal of hope. Because if the only thing that's standing between me and the promises of the program, serenity, happiness, whatever you want to call it, is something that I can change, then that is a great deal of hope. And I think that's what the program offers. It teaches me to shift the perspective from laying the blame and responsibility on everything that's screwed up in my world out on someone else and zeroes it in on me. And that means that I do not have to wait for someone else to straighten out before I can get happy. Because I'm liable to wait an awful long time. And for some unknown reason, the old ideas I brought into here to AA taught me that. And that was the perspective I had. I looked at the world in terms of fairness. And I kept a little scorecard. And I was a great inventory taker. And I kept track of when things were going fair for me and when things weren't going fair for me, and I reported to anyone who would listen how things were going. And I thought that that was my primary job. I thought that's what sharing was all about, was reporting to someone in charge when things weren't right. And it could be my mother, or in the Marine Corps, I would try to report to some colonel, and he'd punch me. But, I was reporting that things weren't going right. And I guess I figured that my primary function was that of a briefing officer. If you could just explain yourself in sufficient detail, you had done your share. And I came in here and found that that just wasn't the deal at all. That what I was offered was a whole new plan for living, and I suppose that's what I feel like talking about here tonight. If I had to describe how I feel tonight, I would say, did you ever have the thought go through your head, wouldn't it be nice to know what I know now and start all over? Did you ever have that feeling, oh boy, I'd like to be able to start all over knowing what I know now? And I honestly feel that's exactly, if I were to share to you what's going on inside of my head tonight, I would tell you that I have that feeling of starting all over knowing what I know now. Nancy and I got married about 6 months ago. It's a whole new start for us. I feel like if we even start a family, that's okay. I've already got kids that are already grown. I did a lousy job. Maybe I can do a great job this time. I got a job change. I just made a decision about a month ago to make a complete change in jobs, and I start Tuesday. And I'm going back, and a whole new deal. This year has been very good financially. It's been one of these things where my friend Hal Marley back in Washington calls me up on a regular basis, and he says, "Sandy, if there's anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who ought to tell himself that things are going indeed well, it is you." And I'm going, you know, Hal, you're absolutely right. There's, if I shared, you know, my optimism and my outlook on things, it would be extremely positive.
Can you turn the mic up just a little so you can up toward your mouth?
Oh, okay.
There you go.
Is that a little better?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. I apologize. I didn't realize that wasn't coming out. Anyway, forgot where I was. Oh, Hal Marley, yes.
You were listening.
Okay. About 5 years ago, I had a similar call from Hal. And this is part of the program I wanted to talk about before I get into what I had planned. I've had some things I've never shared at a meeting because they've been fairly recent, and I just feel I could get it done here tonight, so I'll go ahead and do it. But I guess about 5 years ago, Hal called me up and was sharing the same kind of thing. He's sort of my alter ego back in Washington. Everybody should have somebody like that who takes your inventory on a daily basis and lets you know how you're doing. And he had called me up, and my wife at that time and I had just bought a house on Capitol Hill. I had just sort of come out of near bankruptcy and had gotten a new job, and you know, you're sitting at 15 years sobriety. I was relating to Bob earlier when he was talking that there's these various peaks that we seem to pass, and it seemed that about 14 or 12, somewhere in there, I was going through bankruptcy, and sobriety didn't seem right at the time. It seemed like, why isn't the program working right? And anyway, at this point in time, I had gotten promoted and was doing rather well, and there were two incomes, and so we had bought this house, and we're entertaining, and it was a nice life. And I remember talking about how it felt. And a couple years later, I was called in, and there was a discussion, and my wife informed me that she was leaving, and there was somebody else, and it was all over, and this was the end of the deal. And the next morning, Hal called me up, and he said, "Sandy, have you counted all the things you can be grateful for today?" And I remember holding the phone out, and I thought what I had heard yesterday was outrageous. But that particular phone call seemed even more outrageous. But I want to share with you the power of that phone call. Because I suppose that during those next couple of months, that's as much pain as I have felt in sobriety. And I wanted relief from it. And that phone call focused me on something that I don't think I would have gone to on my own, which is why I think we need each other so much, especially when we encounter moments that appear unfair, that seem extremely painful, and indeed something like that is supposed to be painful. And the answer to it lay in prayer. And so I will tell you how prayer works in situations like that, because statistically there could be four or five people in this room who are in similar types of painful situations. And so I'll share with you what I think prayer had to do with that particular pain. I probably, in the course of the first 24 hours, said 6,000 Our Fathers with no results. So I called Hal and I said, "This isn't working." And he said, "Keep doing it." And so I would imagine during the first week I came in close to 65,000 Our Fathers. It was just a steady mumbling of, and it would alternate between whining and groveling and hysteria and sobbing and racking, and it was just, "Our Father in heaven, I'll be like that." Why am I doing this? It isn't working. And you know, as the time went on, the pain was excruciating for the proper amount of time for something like that. But at no time during this particular incident did it occur to me that there was another answer. There is tremendous solace in realizing when we get to Alcoholics Anonymous that we've been given the game plan, and that my responsibility is to just continue doing it. And I will share with you that after a couple of weeks, I recall one evening experiencing a break in that pain and probably feeling the greatest peace of mind I've ever had in this program, however brief it may have been. It was just a moment of realizing where I knew deep down in my heart that contrary to all of my feelings and all of these pains and all of this mental exercise I was going through, I had the feeling that I have had in AA, I would say, the last 10 years, that fundamentally everything is just fine. That fundamentally I'm going along in just the right direction and everything is going to work out. And when it does, afterwards, when you get on the other side, you will look back, you will understand it, and you will be glad that it happened. And I stand here tonight and I can tell you I'm delighted that happened. I can tell you that I've been taken out of a position of relative happiness and placed in one that is many times more happy. I could tell you, if I went back to my early years in the program or back to the drinking years, that is not how I would have shared this story with you. I have a hunch I would have had a different perspective on what happened. And I would have had a lot more opinions on what happened and what we ought to do as a gang. You know? And I just wanted to get that out, because sobriety is not a plan to ensure a certain result, but rather a plan and a power to enable us to have a happy sobriety no matter what comes our way. That, to me, is what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. The ability to stay on course through the good weather and the bad weather. When I had been sober about 2 years, I went to a meeting every night, and I came into AA in the Marine Corps, and I was a jet pilot, and it was a very exciting career that I had going. They called it a career, I called it a hobby. It was something that I was able to give about 4 hours a day to, and my alcoholism was my full-time job, and that was requiring a great deal more attention. But at any rate, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been grounded from flying, I had had seizures and been locked up in a nut ward and was let out of the nut ward after about 6 months. The Marine Corps had to make a decision about what to do with a former pilot who they were not letting fly anymore. who had gotten in such bad shape that his hands were trembling and his voice quavered all the time. And so to show that I wasn't the only one suffering from a lack of sanity, I will share with you that the Marine Corps decided to make me an air traffic controller. So I became an air traffic controller, and eventually I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't kill anybody, bring him around in bad weather and so on down. But I did go to a meeting every night for the first year. And at the end of that time, I was the captain in the Marine Corps, and I was eligible for promotion. And this is a very crucial rank to achieve, major, because then you are guaranteed to continue your career. It's sort of a very pivotal point, and you get two shots at it. So my first year of sobriety, the list comes out, and neither my sponsor or myself is on it. So we experienced this is a non-Jewish term, but they call it a Passover. And, so we talked to each other and we said, well, that's because the Marine Corps doesn't understand alcoholism, but wait till next year. We're both doing wonderful jobs. I'm sure that they will be enlightened and we will get this all straightened out. So I went to meetings every night for another year and was getting very good marks at work and so on down, mainly because I was showing up and my brain was working and life was quite a bit different. And the following year, he got promoted and I didn't. And he gave me a pep talk about how I would enjoy civilian life, wouldn't have to wear these uniforms anymore. And in spite of his pep talk, I had a resentment. But I didn't share resentments very well in those early years because I didn't want to look bad. You know what I mean? I didn't want anybody to know the program wasn't working. So you pretend you don't have any resentments and you walk around telling everybody whenever they ask you, how are things going? You go, great. Even if you're thinking of murder at the time, you just go, great, great, great. Sobriety is great. And then at home at night, I would beat up a couple of my kids and, getting dressed for a meeting. And then go to the meeting, and if I was leading, I would lead on humility or some topic like that. And give you a very good discussion of the program and the wonders of it and how happy my life had become in spite of this temporary setback. But deep in my heart was a rage that was becoming an inferno, and I was not going to share that with anybody. So the months went by, and all of a sudden it was a reality, and I'm out, and I hadn't even looked for a job, and so I had to hustle up a quick sales job. I was selling office copiers. I didn't even know how to sell. It was just out of the blue. Six kids, I'm trying to feed everybody, no money. And I started feeling that the program was unfair. This was a very strong feeling that I had. This program was unfair. Because there was another guy in our group who just inherited a lot of money. And in my judgment, his program wasn't half as good as mine. And I remember focusing in on unfair sobriety, unfair. And I didn't tell anybody about this. I didn't want to get somebody else drunk by ruining to them that AA was not what it was cracked up to be. I would keep that my own secret. But as far as I was concerned, it was a rather big failure. And the more I focused in on that and started devoting more of my attention to this injustice, the bigger it got. I have found if you want to really mess around with a resentment, don't share it. Keep it to yourself. Go up in your room, lock the door, take the phone off the hook, And it's like putting yeast in bread, you know, and putting it in the oven. And, in a matter of a few hours, it went right past the Holocaust in terms of a world injustice. And so this is how I was seeing things. And that was the way I was brought up. That's the perspective I brought to AA. That is the perspective that is so necessary to change in order to see the promises of the program, in order to see justice in the world, in order to see the kindness in people. The perspective had to change, but it wasn't changed at that moment in time. But I always like to share this. It was, and I started a direct communication with God. And I would let him know about every hour how I felt, how this was threatening my sobriety, how I'd probably be drunk soon, and it would be his fault. Because after all, I'm the one who went to the meeting every day. I went to the meeting every day. I didn't drink, and it was supposed to get better. And it was terrible. And it was, mostly, it was unfair. That was the key word, unfair. And somewhere in the middle of this discourse with God, I was reading the Washington Post, and back in the, near the end, there was a short paragraph about a team of Marine officers. And as I read about it, it was the one I was on. It was an instruction team that traveled around to other service schools and made a two-day presentation all about the future of the Marine Corps. And my job was, I was the operations officer for that team. And it had just flown into a mountain in Denver, Colorado, killing everyone on the team. And, of course, it became apparent to me that if I had had my way and had gotten promoted, I would have been on that plane. So there was a short period of relief. And there was immediately followed by a period of embarrassment because I knew that God knew I was reading this article. And at the same time, you know, that and I said something like, well, Jesus Christ, if you had just told me I wouldn't. So I guess that was lesson number one in perspective changing. That I recall in my sobriety. That was a very significant development. And I look back, and there's a funny thing about the significant perspective altering that has occurred in my sobriety. I don't know about anybody else's sobriety. All of them have occurred during intense pain. Now, maybe some of you are intellectually curious, and you get your act straightened out voluntarily. This has not been the case with me, I will have to tell you that. I would like to claim credit for this, and I share this for the benefit of anybody who is new. You know, if you're brand new and you really haven't asked any questions, and you're just in the midst of this crowd, and you hear speakers coming up, and we're talking about, then I decided to do an inventory, and then I decided meditation, and then I decided I wanted to get closer to God, and then I decided I wanted to become the best possible person I could become. You could be sitting there going, I've never felt like that in my life. I must be in the wrong crowd. I must be uniquely awful. So what you're missing, I think in the computer world, they call it a modem. And what I need to do is serve as a translator for you so that you understand our AA jargon when you hear us talking about, and then I decided to take a fourth step. They're way ahead of me. When you hear a speaker say, "And then I decided to take a fourth step," what it was really meant by that statement is, then my sponsor said he'd break my leg if I didn't take a fourth step. That's the one. And if that makes you feel at home, that's it. That's what we meant when we say, "And then I decided." There's a chapter in the Big Book to the agnostic. I think it's a great chapter. I don't know what. I was talking to Clancy before. He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Chapter in the Big Book about the agnostic." Because I have some funny memories about that chapter, and I don't know, maybe there's some new people, you have the same type thing. Early on, I had this big sponsor. He was the Marine. When he came to my house, he filled the door, if you know what I mean. And I had made the call to Intergroup, and then I got a drink to stay down after I made the call. My problem was I couldn't get any booze to stay down. I thought I was going to die. So I called AA with an emergency. So they got a hold of this guy down at the Quantico Marine Base, and he's on his way over. Now I got some vodka to stay down, so I called him back. I didn't want to waste their resources on a. And they said, "Too late, he's on his way." And I'm going, "Oh, God, I got to get rid of this guy." And he just filled the door frame and came in, and and he just stood there, and he just went, "Hi, my name's Bill. This is a 12-step call. I talk, you listen." We're in deep trouble here. So this guy, you know, get in the car. That was the basic message. I remember going, "Well, Bill, I won't be able to do it. Get in the car." You know, I'm going, "No, I gotta. Why don't you leave some literature, and I'll look it over." And get in the car right now, you know. So for a long time, I thought that was AA's first step. Get in the car. The second step. The second step was sit in the front row. That was Incurable Row. Sit there. Don't talk. But soon, he had us going to a meeting every night, and soon it was Big Book time. And he said, "Have you got a Big Book yet?" So all of a sudden, I started all about the Big Book. And I knew he was serious, and I knew that there was no way of getting around it. So I did. I don't know if any, I'm sure other people have done it. I got a Big Book immediately. And then I took it home that night, and I opened it, you know, about 9 different places. Then I messed some pages up, you know what I mean? Folded them around. I took some coffee and slotted it around. Then I underlined some pages. And in 20 minutes, that book looked like it had been around for years. You know what I mean? The guy had really worked. But I didn't read one word. I did not read one word. I'm not one of these guys who got the Big Book and digested it. You know, I just went, "That's enough of that. I don't want to get into this thing too far. These people are fanatics." I saw through the day at a time thing immediately. Don't give me that stuff. You're only staying sober today. There's people up here that are never planning on drinking again. Now, don't give me that day at a time stuff. I'm just staying sober today. I'm going, "Oh, ha, 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 ha." Why does that cake say 5 years? You know how you are. So I said, "I want to get brainwashed. What if they develop a cure to alcoholism?" You know? I want to keep my options open. Keep your options open. You cannot move. But you got your options open. You can't go anywhere. You must remain stationary if you keep your options open. And that's what I did. But anyway, I had a big book, and I do remember looking at the index, and there was a chapter, or flipping through it, maybe I saw the title on the top, The Agnostic. Now, I'm one of these people who lots of times can tell what's in there without reading it. Isn't that nice? Certain of us in the program were gifted this way. I think they call it contempt prior to investigation. You know? Somebody suggests we do the steps and we say, no, I've already read them. They wouldn't work for me. So I knew what was in the chapter to the agnostic without reading it. It was the chapter that told agnostics how to stay sober. And then the rest of the morons did the steps and did all the rest of the program. So I knew eventually I would fit in the chapter to the agnostic if I read it. And there came a time, and if you're new and you think that's what that chapter says, or that's the contents of that chapter, I call it the Jack Benny chapter. Now, the reason I call it that is because there is a choice that is, well, in the first place, I'll tell you, if you want a brief summary of the chapter, I can give it to you in about four words, three words. Chapter to the Agnostic says, change your mind. That's the chapter to the Agnostic. But anyway, it lays out a rather interesting dilemma. I think we're always faced with dilemmas here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we heard a pretty good discussion of that earlier. But this is one that I always connect back to Jack Benny, who I used to talk about this in Washington, and a bunch of young people came up later on and said, what was so funny about that? And I realized they didn't know who Jack Benny was, and... For those of you that may not know, he was quite a great comedian, and his renowned character was that of being very cheap and tight with money, and probably the funniest radio show that he ever did had this little bit in it where Jack Benny's walking down the hallway, all you can hear is the footstep, click, 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 and all of a sudden a voice comes out and goes, stick 'em up, your money or your life? And then starts the silence. 10 seconds. 15 seconds. There's just silence, and the radio audience laughter starts building, and there's just still nothing. You know, it goes on almost forever. And finally, the guy with the gun says, well? And Benny says, I'm thinking. And you sit and you howl at someone who would be in that position where they would be going, God, I don't know whether to give my money away or get blown away. And there is a discussion in the chapter of the agnostic. And I think Bill has a marvelous sense of humor. And I find it all through the big book, the 12 and 12. But there's a little couple of sentences in there where he says, for the alcoholic, to choose between living a life based on spiritual principles or dying an alcoholic death is not always an easy choice. And that's what step two or the chapter of the agnostic is all about. You know, you come in and you get the rug yanked out from under you, and if you're new and you've seen this first step about being powerless over alcohol, I remember coming up against that one, and you better watch out if you admit you're powerless over alcohol, because that's a dangerous position intellectually to get yourself in. So if you admit you're powerless over alcohol, you can't learn your way out of that. You are... You can only be helped out of that. You must find a power. And so powerless is a rather big word. And it's sort of the key to our program, that's the fundamental nature of our problem. I can't learn about alcoholism. I can't learn all valuable insights and have them fix me. They can help me, but I'm still don't have the power to put into practice all of the things that I've learned. My problem was powerlessness. And so when we take an alcoholic and we educate them all about alcoholism, then we have a person who is lying on the floor drunk but knows precisely why. But they're still drunk every day because the problem was not that they didn't know anything about alcoholism. The problem was powerless over alcohol. So our dilemma was powerlessness, and that was what mine was, and I didn't want to admit it. I did not want to surrender. I didn't. I was afraid to. I couldn't surrender. What would take over if I surrendered? I didn't believe in a God. I had heard of one from the nuns that so many of us had as children, and I had abandoned that one as punishing and frightening and so on down. But those were childish ideas, and they should have been replaced with grown-up ideas, except as an alcoholic, I had an alternative to growing up. It was called vodka. Why go through the pain of growing up when you can drink? Drink three, you are a grown-up. You intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. It was like you activated the system, and it gave us a different perspective, and it showed me. So there really were 14 promises of vodka, and they all work just like the promises in the big book. So I can relate to the higher power of vodka just as much as I can the higher power I found in AA. The difference is vodka didn't love me. That was the problem. It worked, but it just didn't have my best interest at heart. But the program works very similar in my life to that feeling I had with alcohol. I had great faith in alcohol. I didn't even actually have to drink alcohol to have it work. Just knowing if I could look out the window and see my car in the parking lot, just knowing the vodka was there in the glove compartment would calm my body down. It wasn't even in my system, just knowing it was there. Sometimes when we get sober, we have a $50 bill hidden in our wallet, just in case. You got to cover yourself, right? What if there is no God? Or worse than that, what if there is a God and it's really true, you are the one person he doesn't like? And you know all those frightening questions? The only way to get them answered is to go find out, is to go ask. And the only way to go ask is to come up against this dilemma that I was talking about, to live a life on spiritual principles or to die an alcoholic death. Not always an easy choice to make. And I think what helps us make it is our disease. I've looked back on it, and the disease is what gave me the perspective that I had to choose the life based on spiritual principles. My impression of AA's first step goes something like this. You come into the AA program, they take you up on top of a parachute tower and throw you off without a chute. And about 3 feet from the cement deck, a big hand comes out and goes and grabs you just before you hit. Says, "Excuse me, we're conducting a survey. Do you believe in God?" That's the time to ask. And it, if you're new, you hear God and higher power and so on down in AA. It isn't that AA has a God. I don't think AA demonstrates a particular God. As a matter of fact, it says higher power of your choice, of your understanding, God as you understand him. So it's up to me to figure out this God. But what AA does, as far as I'm concerned, without any shadow of a doubt, it teaches me the need for one. That's what I learned early on. It says, "You don't believe in God?" I said, "No, I don't." "You're in deep trouble." A non-alcoholic, they might be able to get away with it. You? Let's explain alcoholism. And then I'm up on the tower, they throw me off, and they're going, well, how about now? And I go, well... Because you see, 3 feet from the cement, even a macho Marine doesn't look bad changing his mind there, right? So if you're worried about your ego, you go, hey, anybody would change their mind here. And that's what our first step is for. Help you change your mind. We explain the true nature of the situation. We pull the rug out from under. And you find that there you are, firmly planted in midair, with no invisible means of support, as they say. And the choice then can become a little easier. And I think that's what's so beautiful. Because of my illness, because of the desperate nature of the situation, I made a decision I never would have made had I had other circumstances in my life. And my decision was, okay, what's this spiritual crap? You know what I mean? That was the thing. And I like to share that with new people. It wasn't, I saw the brilliant enlightenment of this program. I saw the desperate situation I was in and really saw for the first time there wasn't any other choice. And so by default rather than by virtue, I was hustled down the middle of the road path, the broad highway that Bill writes about, in our 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, kicking and screaming and swearing they don't work and just the standard recovery that all of us have. Just marching along. And what I'm sharing with you tonight is I am so glad that that happened to me that sometimes I like to take credit for it. I like to stand up here, you know, and just go, God, it's been great being in these steps and doing this. And I was always doing them against my better judgment. You know what I mean? As I wrap this up, I'm going to share with you some incidents to show you what I'm talking about. There's a... when John Lennon died, in Time magazine, they had one of his songs printed. And due to drinking or being the wrong age or whatever, I never really listened to anything the Beatles did, so I couldn't have even told you one of their songs. But I was very into this at this moment in time. I remember reading this, and this particular song was Watching the Wheels Go By. And the particular line that caught my eye was, there's no problems, only solutions. There's no problems, only solutions. And what happens, let me tell you if you're new, why this is so valuable. In Alcoholics Anonymous, in my judgment, we don't ever figure out our alcoholism. We never understand it. We don't learn about it. As a matter of fact, we sort of put that over here, we just don't drink, and we work on other things. And when we work on these other things, like inventory and amends and prayer and meditation, and then we look back at our alcoholism, we find it's been removed. It isn't there bothering us on a daily basis. We have a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. As long as we're into working the solution, the problems that aren't ours to worry about in the first place get taken care of some other way. Alcoholism, drinking, just doesn't come up in my mind as something I have to fight. I don't fight off drinking. But if I stop working the solution, I'm sure I would. It's as if a higher power said, Sandy, you work this, I'll take care of the alcoholism. Okay, that's a deal. So I work it, he takes care of the alcoholism, just holds it over here. I go months at a time, I never think about drinking. If I stop working the solution to a particular situation and you decide this is the situation that the steps don't cover. And about that time the higher power says, you want it back, you got it. And This is not, you know, I say up here, this is ha, 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 in, you know, kind of in a humorous way, but this is real. I mean, over the years, and it's not me that decides that the program is the answer, it is you. When I'm in great pain, my brain is telling me there has to be some other answer, there has to be some other solution. And so when I'm at meetings and I'm sharing, and I'm the type of person who at discussion meetings, I very rarely am I going to raise my hand when the leader says, does anybody have a problem? Because I don't want anybody to think a guy with 15 years sobriety has a problem. Might ruin some newcomer's opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for their sake, I'll stay screwed up. Right? That's advanced humility, right? But occasionally the situation can be so horrible, the resentment so deep, the pain so intense, you've got your hand up. And I had my hand up that time I told you about getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. And I've been sober about 2 years, went to the meeting every night, and the leader says at the discussion meeting out in Manassas, Virginia, says, anybody got a topic tonight? And I got my hand up. I said, yeah, I'm getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. I got all these kids, I don't have a job, I don't know what I'm going to do, it's totally unfair. I said, okay, let's discuss Sandy's problem tonight, being thrown out of the Marine Corps. Called on the first guy, he said, thrown out of the Marine Corps. Have you tried the Serenity Prayer? Called on the next guy, he said, thrown out of the Marine Corps. How about the prayer of St. Francis? Make me a channel of thy peace. That's what I'd do. Thrown out of the Marine Corps, I'd use the prayer of St. Francis. Next guy said, you got to get into action. I'd find a new person and work with them. Into action. Get a new person and work with them. I never went back to that group. But on the way home, I tried to have an open mind. And I said to myself, part of the blame must lie with me. I obviously didn't explain the problem correctly, or they never would have said what they did. So it must have been 6 or 7 years later. I had another situation. Terrible divorce situation, family, moving out, all the kids, one of those terrible things. And I was in so much pain, I had my hand up, and I said, I want to discuss, you know, divorce, and I'm losing the kid, and the father, and the problem, and all my possessions, and they're gone, and everything. So they call on the first guy, oh, divorce. Have you tried the Serenity Prayer? Tried the Serenity Prayer. Next guy said, have you tried the prayer of St. Francis? Make me a channel of thy peace. That's what I'd do, prayer of St. Francis. Make me a channel of thy peace. And the next guy said, no, I'd go get some new people into action. Get involved with somebody else. Get out of yourself. Forget that. Go over and help somebody else. And 5 years later, I was sharing a little bit. I was in the real estate business and the money market dried up. There was no mortgage money and I'm going bankrupt and everything. And so I had my hand up again. I wanted to discuss bankruptcy and employment. You know what I mean? Well, I'm going through bankruptcy. I'm very talented. You know, a little free advertising. So the topic that night was being broke. Money, bucks, big bucks. Money, money, money. That was the topic. First guy. Have you tried the Serenity Prayer? I was hoping for, would you like a small loan? Serenity Prayer, prayer of St. Francis, get out there and work with some new people, you know. So what do we got here? We got a universal answer. A universal answer. And that shouldn't be surprising to alcoholics. We had it before we got here. Did you have a specific drink that you used for different problems? So I guess for me, if I were to share with anybody who is new, is you're on to it. This is it. All you got to do is get better at it. All you got to do is just get better at it. I really believe that when they say that those who scoff at prayer haven't prayed enough. The thing about sticking with it, the thing about just realizing that your own higher power, your own relationship with a higher power, is the permanent answer. It can never let you down. It removes a lot of debate. It removes a lot of the decision-making process. It is what faith is all about. It's not designed to cause certain results. It's designed to turn out a great product. It's designed to produce what Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about, the ultimate product of Alcoholics Anonymous, to become a child of God. Thank you very much.